morning.
If you've got a Bible, we're going to be in John chapter 9. John chapter 9, we pick back up our series on Memorize John after I was gone last week. Hopefully it gave you a chance to review the first 8 chapters in our effort to try to memorize the main ideas of the Gospel of John. This morning, we're on chapter 9, and just a little bit about the context. Jesus is still in Jerusalem. You know, most of Jesus' earthly ministry was in Galilee, but for a few chapters now, Jesus has been in Jerusalem. He initially came to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles in chapter 7, but is still in Jerusalem in chapter 9. And so that's the setting for this account that takes place. And here's the graphic. This is simply the number 9 with turned into an eyeball. But if you're familiar with this text, hopefully that will make sense. All of chapter 9 involves one of the miracles of Jesus and the conversation and accusations that fly surrounding that healing. And the healing is specifically of a blind man. And so that is what this graphic is meant to represent. To remember the eyes were healed of this man who was born blind. Already have it up on the wall along with the other 8 chapters to help us remember these main ideas. As far as the outline of John chapter 9, this is going to be all blanks because what we're going to do, and this is in your handout on the back of the bulletin, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to do a really quick survey of chapter 9. And then I want to hit on one thing. So you may say, well, this is a one-point sermon, okay? I've told this before, but my mentor, Dr. Marlon Conley, who was a professor at Lipscomb, it was relayed to me that one time a student at Lipscomb said, "Dr. Conley, how many points should a good sermon have?" And he said, "Well, at least one." So this one will have one, okay, that I hope you can take away with you. If you want to take away more, that's awesome. But there's really one big one I want you to take away from this morning. And so, again, we're just going to work through as kind of a high-level survey of this chapter that revolves around the healing of this blind man. And so, picking up in verse 1, it says, "As he passed by," and again, I wanted to set that context that he's in Jerusalem. It doesn't tell us exactly where he is in Jerusalem. If I were to guess, I would say he's in the temple area because you have this blind man who later is intimated that he's a beggar. Most likely, if he was a beggar, he would be in the place where there would be the largest concentration of people passing by, which would have been the Temple Mount, the temple area. Again, we're not told that. It's just a guesstimation, a guess, if you will, of where he might be. But it says, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. Now, I have in your bulletin, Jesus encountered numerous individuals who were blind in his ministry. And he healed them. But the thing that makes this unique is that this man is described as having been blind from birth. Now, maybe some of the other ones who were blind that he healed, and again, I've got a bunch of references in your bulletin, we won't take the time to go to those, but none of those specifically say that those he healed were blind from birth. Maybe some of them were, but many of them it will say that when Jesus grants them their sight, that they had recovered their sight as though they had it before or lost it and came back. But this is a man who was blind since birth. He's been blind since birth. And then it says in verse 2, his disciples asked him, "Rabbi," which just simply means teacher, "who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And the reaction from the disciples is more curiosity than compassion, right? When they look at this blind man, they don't see someone that deserves their compassion because or empathy, but instead they're curious about the source of his blindness. And so for that one, I've got the word in consideration. Maybe not, I may use the word inconsiderate, but probably not in consideration. But it is a word. I looked it up. It is a word. It's in the dictionary. But in consideration, they're not considerate about his condition. They're more, again, curious about what was the source of his blindness. Not understanding the nature of life and even the nature of sin. There's a lot of times the disciples are confused about how things work, as we are, and as we would have been in their situation, or at least I would have been. But Jesus doesn't accept either one of their alternatives. Did the man sin? Did the parent sin? Is that why he's blind? He doesn't accept either one of those. But he says, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. Now, if you go back to chapter 5, just quickly, you don't have to turn there, but just think. Chapter 5, you have another one of the miracles of Jesus. In chapter 5, you have the lame man that was healed at the pool of Bethesda. And after that healing, there's a long conversation between Jesus and the Pharisees. And one of the things that the Pharisees are wanting to kill him because he has just said that God is his Father. And Jesus, instead of backing off from that claim, doubles down on him. He three more times says, I'm equal with God. And in one of those times, he says, God has given me these great works, and even greater works are coming. And this is another one of those works that's coming, right? He's going to heal this blind man. So he says, it wasn't that he sinned or that his parents sinned, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. This is the providence of God that put this blind man in my path. And he says, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day, meaning while we have opportunity. He says, night is coming when no one can work. There's going to be a time when we no longer have an opportunity to work. So we have to work while we have opportunity. You remember, those of you that were in the Hebrews class, in the section where he's talking about Jesus being greater than Moses, and he quotes from the Psalms, and he says, you know, today, while it is, and that means do it today, do this today while you still have opportunity. That's what this means. While you have opportunity, while it's still day. And he says, as long as I am in the world, and he repeats a claim he made back in chapter 8, I am the light of the world. Something that John, the apostle who wrote this gospel, said about Jesus in chapter 1. In him was, he is light, and in him was life. That light was the life, in him was life, and that life was the light of the world. Sorry, I went a little crazy on that quote there. But in him was life, and that life was the light of the world. And he says, he told the crowd in chapter 8, I am the light of the world. And again, now he tells his disciples, I am the light of the world. He says, so work while it's day. And then if you move into verse 6, here's where Jesus performs the miracle, and I have labeled this demonstration. So from inconsideration of disciples, you have demonstration where Jesus performs this miracle. But the way he performs the miracle is unusual. I mean, as if any miracle would not be unusual, right? But this is definitely unique in the way Jesus performs miracles, because Jesus performed miracles when he wasn't even in the presence of the one he healed. He performed miracles when someone merely touched his cloak. So there was nothing Jesus had to have happen in order for him to perform a miracle, but sometimes he requested things to be done by certain individuals in order to receive what he was going to give them. And this is one of those cases. And here's the demonstration. It says, having said these things, meaning to the disciples, he spit on the ground. You're like, whoa, okay, this is taking a left turn. He spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud. So again, in case there's any misunderstanding, spits on the ground, mixes it together with the dirt to make mud, pulls up a pack of mud and puts it in the man's eyes. Someone I read this week said, maybe one of the reasons why he did this was because the man was born blind. He wanted the man to be able to feel that something had been done to his eyes. I don't know. Whatever the reason, Jesus packs his eyes with mud. And then he tells him, he gives him this instruction. He says, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent, literally what Siloam means. The pool of Siloam was a pool that was created, a man-made pool, but was filled with the water from the spring of Gihon, or a rerouting of the spring of Gihon. On the southern end of the city of Jerusalem, we'll talk about that in a second, but he says, I want you to go wash in the pool of Siloam. Now, I want to show you a couple of slides from Jerusalem just to emphasize one aspect of this, okay? I said at the beginning, I don't know where this event took place, other than I know where the pool of Siloam is. I've been there twice. But I don't know where the first encounter with this man was, but perhaps it was at the temple area, okay? Because again, if you're a beggar, where are you going to go? Where there's the most traffic? And where would the traffic have been? People coming in and out of the temple. Maybe. I don't know. But here is in Jerusalem at the Israel Museum. Have I ever told you guys that at one point this was in the lobby of a hotel? That's where it was originally was. This thing is, look at the people in the back, how tiny they are. That gives you a sense of how big this model is. Yeah, this used to be in the lobby of a hotel. That's where it was originally. But now it's at the Israel Museum. But this is a model of the city of Jerusalem from technically just after the time of Jesus. We can talk about that another time. But this would be, at, you know, as if I'm standing on the east side of the city looking west, and by far the most prominent thing in the foreground is the Temple Mount. This is the Temple Mount built by Herod the Great with the temple up on top. Speaking of beggars, if you remember the beggar in Acts chapter 3, the lame man who was the beggar who was at the Gate Beautiful. That Gate Beautiful is this little gate right here that separated the court of the Gentiles from the court of the women. So again, perhaps this blind beggar was in the temple area. But this is the temple. Again, this is on the eastern side of the city. Now, I'm going to flip my angle. Here's the Temple Mount up here. And on the extreme southern end of the city, you have the Pool of Siloam. Okay? And the Pool of Siloam, I can tell you from a firsthand account, is not only a decent distance away, but is also a long way down. I mean, it's significant change in elevation to go down to the Pool of Siloam. And there actually was a road that connected the temple down to the Pool of Siloam. And so if we assume that the man was up here in the temple area and he's blind, Jesus gave him a task to do that wasn't inconsequential for someone who was blind. He said, you got to go somewhere and you got to wash this mud off in the Pool of Siloam. Okay? Again, not inconsequential, especially for someone who was blind. And just as, you know, this is the remains of the Pool of Siloam that are there today. You can see the corner of it. The whole thing is not still intact, but you can see one corner of it and then us sitting on, again, it's crazy in Israel. They just let you sit on all the artifacts. It's crazy. But this is the edge of what would have been the Pool of Siloam. Okay? So, but Jesus heals it. Well, how do we know he heals him? Because he tells him to go wash, and then what happens? Read the rest of that verse. It says, so he went and washed. So even though the man had to go do something, and probably something inconvenient because he's blind and he's got to travel to the far southern end of Jerusalem, it says he went and washed, and he came back, what? Seeing. So wherever he was, he came back there, but now he can see. I wonder what that... If you've never, you know, you have one of the blind men who was healed in Jesus' ministry who after he was healed said that the men appeared like trees, right? Because probably he'd been able to see before, he knew what a tree looked like. But I wonder what, having never seen before, and now he can see, I mean, it had to be just sensory overload, right? But he can see, okay? He can see. So he's back where he started, and he can see. So then that leads to, in verses 8 through 12, a lot of conversation, a lot of hoopla, if you will. Because here you've got this man who has been blind since birth. They know him as a beggar, and now he can see. And he's claiming that he can see. But some of the people are like, this can't be the same guy. It can't be the same guy. And so I've labeled this one speculation. Okay, look at verse 8. The neighbors, meaning those who were in the vicinity, and those who had seen him before as a beggar, were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, no, no, but he's like him. It's not the same guy, but he looks like him." But he kept saying what? "I'm the man. It's me. It's me." He kept saying it, but they kept having an argument. Is it the man? Is it not the man? Is it the man? No, no, it's just someone who looks like him. So they said, "Well, then how were your eyes open?" And he answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go into Siloam and wash.' So he went and washed. I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, "I do not know. I don't know." Remember, he left and went to Siloam and came back. He says, "Now, I don't know where he is. I don't know where he is." And so this hoopla, this speculation, leads to two encounters with the Pharisees. Two encounters with the Pharisees. And the first one of the encounters I have labeled interrogation, because now the Pharisees want to get to the bottom of this. And not only do they want to get to the bottom of whether or not this man was actually healed, but they also want to get to the bottom of, guess when this healing took place? On the Sabbath, again, just like in John 5. Okay? That was when the beginning of when the Pharisees wanted to kill him. One, because he healed on the Sabbath, and two, because he claimed that God was his father. But now, this interrogation is, we got to figure out, is this true? And also, how could someone who's a sinner, meaning because he healed on the Sabbath, heal somebody? How could he actually heal somebody? So it says they brought him, meaning the neighbors. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Okay, the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. So he's telling them, having to tell the story again. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" So they continue to disagree. You know, you think about every time Jesus, you know, does a miracle where there's a crowd, there's division. What do we do with it? What do we do with this? And, you know, I'm not going to hammer on this a lot, because you see this over and over in John, is whenever anyone is presented with Jesus, you have to say, "Well, what am I going to do with it?" That was true then, it's true now. Right? When presented with Jesus, you have to say, well, you have to answer for yourself, "What am I going to do with Jesus?" It happens over and over in the Gospel of John. And again, same thing for us today. You wouldn't be here if you didn't at least know something about Jesus. And you have to ask the question, "Well, what am I going to do with it? What am I going to do with what I know about Jesus? What am I going to do?" Same thing there. But he says, "How can this man who was a sinner," and there was division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes?" And he said, "He is a prophet." A little different than the man who was healed at Bethesda, who, when he was accused of being a lawbreaker for picking up his mat after Jesus had healed him, he kept pointing at Jesus, like, "No, that's the lawbreaker. No, that's the lawbreaker. No, that's him." This man's going, "He's a prophet. He's a prophet, as far as I'm concerned. He's a prophet." Since the Jews did not believe that he had been blind and received sight. So what do? They call the parents. They call the parents of the man who had received the sight, and he asked them, "Is this your son who they say was born blind, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But now he sees, but how he now sees, we do not know. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." And then John gives us a little commentary. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. So in essence, they're throwing their son under the bus. Let him deal with it. Let him deal with the consequences. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." Now, that investigation, which leads them to the parents, takes them then to another encounter with the man who had previously been blind. They've now sought out, was he really healed? And so now that they've heard from the parents, they switch from, were you really healed? Who healed you? It couldn't be the sinner that healed you, to they're going to start getting in his face and chastising him. And I'm actually, the word I'm using here is castigation. Because they're going to get in his face and they're going to start hammering on him. They're going to start hammering on him. This is the second appearance before the Pharisee. So he said, for the second time, this is verse 24. The second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. Meaning, give the credit to God. Don't give the credit to this false prophet, this sinner. And he answered, whether he's a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. He says, can't deny that I can see, when previously I couldn't. And they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are the disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. The man answered, why? This is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. You know, you think about Peter. I don't have this in the bulletin. Peter in Acts 2, he's preaching about Jesus. He says, this man, meaning Jesus, that God testify to you through signs and wonders and miracles. And this man is like arguing with the Pharisees. Like, it's like, how could you possibly deny the power in what happened here? How could you possibly, why are you trying to disclaim this or get me to talk against him when it's evident what happened? When it's evident what happened. He says, why? This is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. He's arguing on the behalf of Jesus. I mean, throughout this, the Pharisees are constantly going, this man's a sinner. How could you listen to him? How could you give him the credit? And the man is constantly going, because he did it. Because he did it. It says, never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. It's like, who else could do this? If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they answered him, you were born in utter sin and you would teach us. And they cast him out. So from your claiming that this sinner healed you to now you were born in utter sin and they cast him out. And so now, at the very end of this, and you, those of you that were in class this morning, you heard Sam read this before class. And I appreciate him reading it. At the very end of this, where the man did not know where Jesus was when he came back from Siloam, but now, when Jesus hears he's been cast out from the Pharisees, Jesus seeks him out. And I just simply labeled this as summation, because this is down to the conclusion, but this is really the pinnacle of the encounter. To me, the pinnacle of the encounter is not the healing. It's not the argument between the man and the Pharisees, or the Pharisees and the parents, or the neighbors and the Pharisees. The pinnacle is not any of that. Because what this really is a story about the building of faith. About the development of this man's faith in God, this faith in Christ. Because look at what happens. As Jesus heard they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Well, initially, there's a little bit of confusion because the man's like, I don't know who you're talking about. But he answered, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Who is he? Because Jesus used the title Son of Man from the prophecy in Daniel to describe himself. We've talked about that a lot in lessons. He says, who is he that I may believe in him? And Jesus clarifies. He says, you have seen him, and he is the one speaking to you. And they say, oh, now it makes sense. He's more than just a prophet. He's the Son of God. He said, Lord, I believe. That's the pinnacle of this account. Lord, I believe. and he worshiped him. He worshiped him. Why would he worship him unless he recognized him as being God, being the Son of God? And then we have one more encounter with the Pharisees, this time Jesus and the Pharisees. He says, For judgment I came into the world. Those who do not see may see me, and those who see may become blind. And some Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? And Jesus, the answer that Jesus gives is like, if you were really blind, then you could use that as an excuse for not believing. But he says, you've seen. And again, it's back to, you've all encountered me. You all have your eyes open. But you've decided to reject me anyway. Again, what are we going to do with Jesus? And he says, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. Meaning, you come to this with eyes open and you have willfully rejected. You've willfully rejected. So they can't claim their innocence. They can't claim their innocence. Now, here's the thing I want to circle back on. Okay? I mentioned that I believe that this is a story about the development of this man's faith. I think it's way more a story about the development of his faith than it is a story about the healing. Is the healing important? Absolutely. I mean, John, in the end of the gospel, is going to say, you know, I've written about these things so that you may believe, and that in believing you may have life. And God worked these powerful miracles through Jesus to give him credibility, to give credibility to his claim. So is it important? Absolutely, it's important. But the biggest takeaway I have from this is the credibility built in that man and how it led to the development of his faith. And even before he was healed, you begin to see the development of the faith and how that faith was demonstrated. I'll take a quick step back before I jump back into this story. That I do not believe that anything we do makes us worthy of the salvation that we receive from God. Nothing. Nothing. I do not think there is anything we can do to earn it, to deserve it, to be worthy. But yet, I believe there are things that we must do in order to receive it. And for some, that's an almost impossible thing in their minds to reconcile. So how could you possibly say that you have to do something in order to receive it, but doing those things doesn't cause you to deserve it? I have been baffled for years, and I tried really hard not to make a straw man out of any opposing argument or anything else, but I have been baffled for years at the larger Christian world's just absolute denial about the essential nature of baptism. But I also understand their argument. In some cases, I don't agree with it, but I understand how they arrived at where they are. Because they look at it and go, well, we can't earn anything. And again, I already told you I believe that. We can't earn salvation. Salvation is a gift. Ephesians 2:8, for by grace, what is grace? A gift, you have been saved through faith. And so they will conclude, well, if you can't possibly earn it, if you require anything to receive it, then that's violating the concept of earning or of not being able to earn. To me, this is a story, though, that demonstrates how that sometimes it's necessary to do something in order to receive it, even if you don't earn it. Did anything that the blind man did cause him to earn being healed by Jesus? caused him to be worthy of having his sight restored by Jesus. Not even restored, because he never had it. But to be given sight by Jesus. Did anything he did cause him to be worthy of the gift that he received? I don't think so. But yet, what did he have to do in order to be able to receive that gift? He had to make his way to the Pool of Siloam and wash. James said, if you have faith, it is only from your words. Can that faith save him? Faith is not faith unless it's lived out. It doesn't make us worthy of anything. It doesn't make us earn anything. Paul says that over and over and over again. Romans 3, Galatians 2, Galatians 3, and on and on and on. But we still have to do something in order to be able to receive it. And we have to do something in order to demonstrate that it's really faith. Because if you don't have action to build your faith, guess what? It's not faith. It's not faith. And so, to me, this is an incredible story about what the demonstration of faith is all about. Jesus was willing to give him this incredible gift, but the man had to do something in order to receive it. He didn't earn it. But he believed in Jesus enough that he was willing to do what Jesus asked. That's the nature of faith. And that's when it's presented to us of what are we going to do with Jesus, it's not just what are we going to say with our mouth. It's what are we going to do with our lives that demonstrates we believe in the claims of Jesus, we believe in the authority of Jesus, we believe in the divinity of Jesus. What are we going to do with our lives? It doesn't cause us to earn anything, but if Jesus is really going to be our master, we have to live for him. We have to live for him. And that's why I say this is a story about a development of this man's faith and a demonstration of his faith. That he was willing to do something that to most would seem pretty absurd. Right? I just had spit mud put in my eyes and I got to go wash it off. There are many who probably looked at baptism and go, what are they doing? What are they trying to wash off? That's how Jesus has told us we come into contact with his blood. We are united with him in his death, his resurrection. But it doesn't stop there. What does faith mean for the rest of our lives? It means living it out. To earn our salvation? No. Because we believe that Jesus is the only one who can give us eternal life. Because of what he did. If you're here this morning and you've never given your life to Jesus, or if you're here this morning and you've given your life to Jesus, but you need encouragement, just like we all need encouragement, to live it out every day, if there's anything we can do for you, please come. I'll be sending our invitation soon.